content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are in our second reading of the June 15th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. And I'm going to start with a little short piece that we don't always get to. This one is from a section called It Wasn't All Bad. A British cat is being hailed as the world's oldest feline after celebrating its 30th birthday. Michelle Heritage adopted the orange and white cat named Rubble as a kitten in 1988, and the two have been inseparable ever since. Heritage credits the kitty's incredible longevity to the fact that she pampers and dotes on the animal. Despite Rubble's impressive health, Heritage is keen to keep him out of the spotlight. He has plenty of life left in him yet, but I don't think we will go down the Guinness World Record route, she says, explaining that her grumpy pet wouldn't like lots of people coming to see him. And then we'll just go on over to the briefing page. Interesting article this week titled, Rise of the Deep Fakes. New technology makes it alarmingly easy to make realistic videos of people saying and doing things they've never done. What is the technology? It's a sophisticated type of software that makes it possible to superimpose one person's face onto another's body and manipulate voice recordings, creating fake videos that look and sound real. Hollywood studios have long used computer-generated imagery, CGI, to, say, create fleeting appearances of dead actors. But the process used to be prohibitively expensive and laborious. Today, the technology has improved so much that highly realistic visual and audio fakery can be produced by anyone with a powerful home computer. This has already resulted in a cottage industry of fake celebrity porn. But fears are growing over how else deepfake videos could be used, from smearing politicians in elections to inciting major international conflict. Earlier this year, BuzzFeed.com created a, quote, public service announcement warning of the technology's dangers, with a deepfake of former President Barack Obama voiced by the comedian and director Jordan Peele. We're entering an era, the fake Obama says, in which our enemies can make it look like anyone is saying anything. To illustrate the point, the fake Obama goes on to call President Trump a total and complete dip blank. Where did deepfakes originate? In porn, of course. Last December, an anonymous Reddit user who calls himself Deepfakes started posting fake but realistic-looking videos of celebrities engaged in explicit sex. By January, the deepfake technology had been shared through a free app, FakeApp, which has since been downloaded more than 120,000 times. FakeApp and its imitators sparked an explosion of fake pornography online, with Michelle Obama, Ivanka Trump, and Emma Watson among those most frequently victimized. But it's not all porn. The technology has also been used to create harmless spoof and parody videos, inserting Reddit cult figure Nicolas Cage into films in which he didn't appear, for example. How do deepfakes work? The creator gathers a trove of photos or videos of the target, so it helps if it's a famous person, along with a video to be doctored. The video maker then feeds the data into the app, which uses a form of artificial intelligence, AI, known as deep learning, hence deepfake, to combine the face in the source images with the chosen video. This process requires a sizable graphics processing unit and a vast amount of memory. It's time-consuming. The Obama peel video took 56 hours to make, and the quality is variable. But the technology is improving fast. Tech expert Antonio Garcia Martinez, writing for Wired, says we'll soon be able to superimpose anyone's face onto anyone else's, creating uncannily authentic videos of just about anything. How are the voices faked? The principle is the same. You feed lots of recordings of the person you want to fake into an AI program, which chops up sounds and words into discrete bits. Software can then rearrange the sound so the subject can say anything you like. A team of sound engineers recently used deep learning software to analyze 831 of John F. Kennedy's speeches, and then created a convincing approximation of the 35th president reading the speech he was due to deliver the day he was assassinated. Researchers at the University of Washington last year synthesized realistic videos of Barack Obama speaking by mapping audio from one speech onto an existing video of him talking. How much trouble can this cause? Potentially a lot. On deepfake forums, there are frequent requests for help in producing face swap porn videos of ex-girlfriends, classmates, and teachers. In the public sphere, the technology could be even more toxic. Fake videos could show soldiers committing atrocities or world leaders declaring war on another country, triggering an actual military response. Deepfakes could be used to damage the reputation of a politician or a political party, or an entire country. And if fake videos become commonplace, people may start assuming real videos are fake too. That skepticism could be corrosive. It'll only take a couple of big hoaxes, said Justin Hendricks, executive director of NYC Media Lab, to really convince the public that nothing's real. Can deepfakes be stopped? To reduce the potential dangers of deepfakes, videos can be equipped with a unique digital key that proves their origin, or with metadata showing where and when they were captured. Artificial intelligence can be trained to recognize deepfakes and remove them from websites. Deepfakes have already been banned from many porn sites as well as from Twitter. Ultimately, though, the genie is out of the bottle. Fake apps creator Deepfake app, another Reddit user, told ViceNews.com he wanted to give everyday people the opportunity to use technology previously limited to big-budget SFX companies. Most tech experts say people will simply have to adapt to this new normal by recalibrating their trust in the once unimpeachable medium of video. Soon, we won't be able to trust our own eyes. How does artificial intelligence work? At the core of the deepfakes code is a deep neural network, a computing system vaguely modeled on the biological neural networks that make up human brains. Such systems learn or progressively improve their performance by taking in and analyzing vast amounts of data, acquainting themselves with the information via trial and error, and adjusting to feedback about what's wrong and right. Like a brain, AI networks reprogram themselves by reacting to patterns in incoming data, rather than relying on fixed rules. Fake App uses a suite of neural networking tools that were developed by Google's AI division and released to the public in 2015. The software teaches itself to perform image recognition tasks through trial and error. First, Fake App trains itself using training data in the form of photos and videos. Then it stitches the face onto another head in a video clip, accurately preserving the facial expression in the original video. These technologies have been developed by online communities where developers are often happy to share techniques, further accelerating the pace of progress. And we'll read a few of the columns that we didn't get to last week. The first from the U.S., Eric Levitz at nymag.com writes, Trump's short-sighted coal plan. President Trump's bonkers strategy for reviving the coal industry could set a precedent Republicans may come to regret, said Eric Levitz. Trump wants his energy department to force utility companies to buy electric power from struggling coal and nuclear plants at uncompetitive rates, on the grounds that bailing out the declining coal industry serves a national security interest. That, of course, is patently absurd. Nearly every utility company and energy expert agrees that our energy grid, which largely depends on domestic oil, natural gas, hydro, and other U.S. sources, is perfectly stable as is. Moreover, Trump's insistence that plants burn dirty, carbon-rich coal puts the profits of coal magnates above the survival of the planet, which is heating up fast. If this president's imperial assertion of executive power to prop up coal plants becomes a precedent, it's hard to see why a future one couldn't use it to shut them down. Imagine what Elizabeth Warren, for example, could do with the authority Trump is audaciously claiming over private companies, trade rules, and tariffs. If conservatives recoil at the thought of a future Democratic president claiming extraordinary powers to combat climate change, they should implore the current Republican to stop inventing new, extraordinary justifications for exacerbating it. This column comes from Switzerland. Neutrality is not the highest good. Does Swiss neutrality mean that our government can never take a position on foreign conflict? Asked Linus Schopfer. That's what Swiss People's Party lawmaker Roger Koppel argued last week when he opposed, in vain, the historic parliamentary declaration denouncing war crimes in Syria. Neutrality, he said, is our indispensable security guarantee and can be upheld only by our deliberate silence on world affairs. But his is a dangerous miscalculation. Tyrants and imperialists are not interested in neutrality. The British subjugated half of Africa, even though the continent had never meddled in UK affairs. The Nazis overran Belgium despite its explicit neutrality. Look at the Dutch, the Danes. History is littered with peoples who tried to stay out of wars, but were dragged into them anyway. Switzerland was spared the first two world wars not because we were neutral, but because we were lucky. Since then, we've been protected by the twin umbrellas of NATO, which U.S. President Donald Trump is trying to destroy, and the European Union, which is in crisis. Switzerland may soon have to join forces with other democracies against the rising autocrats. What good is it to be safe and neutral if we end up castrated and blinded? And we'll read a couple of international columns. The first from Russia. Babchenko's gift to Kremlin propaganda. Arkady Babchenko may be the Kremlin's most outspoken foe, said Pavel Kangin. But with his faked assassination, he has handed them a weapon that can slay Russian journalism. The Russian journalist, who had fled to Ukraine after receiving Kremlin-linked death threats, collaborated with the Ukrainian Secret Service to stage his own murder at his Kiev apartment last week. Then, not 24 hours after he was supposedly identified at the morgue, Babchenko emerged alive at a press conference to tell us it was a sting to expose a Russian plot. The friends who had wept and mourned, the reporters who'd written anguished obituaries, the international politicians who denounced Russia, all were at first relieved and happy, then outraged at the deception. The Kremlin, of course, which had angrily denied any involvement, just as it denies all the murders and crimes legitimately attributed to it, is rejoicing. It can now blame any crime on fake news. Celebrating with it are conspiracy theorists across the world who now have a brilliant excuse to strengthen their distrust of the media. Reporters in Kiev, of course, did try their hardest to confirm the killing and were still following leads when the hoax was revealed. Babchenko did not die on May 30th. Journalism did. And from South Africa, bringing rugby racism into the open. More than 25 years after the end of apartheid, South African rugby is still struggling with racism, said the Mail and Guardian. The national team, the Springboks, was banned from the sport's first two World Cups in 1987 and 1991 because of an international sports boycott of apartheid South Africa. The end of white minority rule allowed the team to play at the 1995 World Cup. Then President Nelson Mandela cheered the nearly all-white team, but his blessing didn't change rugby culture. Coach Andre Markgraf had to resign 2 years later after he called new black rugby officials blanking Kaffirs, the N-word of South Africa. Fast forward to today, and while the Springboks still have a mostly white lineup, they do have their first black captain. But not all is well in the game. One of South African rugby's first black stars, Ashwin Willemse, who is now a sportscaster, walked off a TV set during a live post-game analysis last week, saying his two white co-anchors, former Bok coach Nick Mallett and former player Nas Bota, had undermined him on air for too long. The episode has exposed the resentment black players and fans feel at the sport's culture of barely concealed prejudice. How long will rugby remain at the center of a white nationalist identity? We'll take in a couple of pieces on the technology page this week. First one, streaming. Can YouTube Music topple Spotify? YouTube is singing a new song, said Jefferson Graham in USA Today. The world's most popular music video platform, with 1.8 billion global users, is taking on the likes of Spotify, Apple Music, and Amazon in the increasingly lucrative music streaming business. Mirroring the approach pioneered by market leader Spotify, YouTube Music, which launched last month, has two tiers, a free ad-supported option and YouTube Music Premium, which costs $9.99 per month and allows unlimited ad-free streaming and playlist curation. One of the selling points for YouTube Music will be the ability to harness the endless amount of information Google knows about you, said AJ Dellinger in Gizmodo.com. With that data, the service hopes to create customized listening experiences and, aided by Google Assistant, deliver users listening recommendations based on the time of day, location, and listening patterns. We're finally getting a legitimate challenger for Spotify and Apple Music, said Micah Singleton in TheVerge.com. Having already acquired the diehard music fans and power users, the other main music streaming services have all shifted their gaze toward the casual listener. YouTube Music is no different, with an emphasis on ease of use over everything else. The app divides its music between three tabs: Home, Hot List, and Library. The Home tab is a revelation and will be a huge user draw, with constantly updated lists tailored to your taste and your location. Hot List is also interesting, essentially serving as YouTube's trending page, but exclusively for music. The Library tab compiles all of your downloads, saved music, recently played songs, and playlists and artists you're following. What's more, the way YouTube has leveraged Google's vast AI and search capabilities is impressive. YouTube Music has a real fighting chance in the streaming market. The fact that you can't automatically play a music video if one exists in the YouTube Music library is a little strange, said Todd Hasselton in CNBC.com. Instead, to find a video, you need to search for the song and then select the music video. That seems like an unnecessary extra step. I think a bigger issue is that YouTube Music just doesn't look all that different from the competition, said Ellis Clopton in Variety.com. The app's user interface looks incredibly familiar, and even the artwork for YouTube curated playlists seems derivative. If you ask me, YouTube Music has likely arrived too late. Most music fans have already made their choice of streaming services and have carefully curated their personalized playlist. They'll find the idea of switching to an entirely new platform for essentially the same price, same experience, a chore. Ancestry and 23andMe in Spit Kit Spat. Genealogy products, tests that tell people where their ancestors hailed from and match them with distant family members, have captured the consumer imagination, said Megan Moltini in Wired.com. The number of people who have submitted a saliva sample and had their DNA analyzed doubled last year to more than 15 million. But Ancestry.com, the industry's biggest player, is being taken to court by rival 23andMe, accused of infringing on patented method for identifying relatives from tidbits of DNA. 23andMe also accused its competition of false advertising and asked the court to nullify the trademarked Ancestry name. The outcome of this lawsuit has the potential to reshape the genetic genealogy testing industry right as it's beginning to boom. The benefit of a password manager. Many of the added conveniences we've grown accustomed to come with their own annoyance. Another password to remember, said Catherine Bindley in the Wall Street Journal. For most of us, memorizing dozens of multi-character passwords simply isn't realistic. Neither is reusing a small number of passwords, which most experts agree is a terrible idea from a security standpoint. One increasingly popular solution, password managers. Essentially a vault that stores your passwords in one place, password managers use a master password to operate as a key unlocking access to all other passwords. After importing the logins you already use, it can generate new and most likely stronger passwords for you, and also fill in logins for pre-selected websites and apps. And it's time for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, When the Ground Melts. Climate change is destroying the permafrost beneath villages and towns across the Arctic, said Melody Schreiber. As roads buckle and buildings' foundations crack, residents are scrambling to adjust to a warmer world. In Russia, buildings are sagging and crumbling. In Greenland, a wildfire broke out last year. And in Alaska, entire villages may be relocated because the land upon which they're built is no longer trustworthy. All across the north, the very ground is changing, and the buildings and roads built upon the thawing permafrost are shifting and cracking. In Iqaluit, the capital of the Canadian territory Nunavut, a good home is hard to find. An efficiency apartment runs around $2,000 a month, while a two-bedroom house will cost about $3,500. These New York prices are shocking in a small remote town of about 7,500 people, and there still aren't enough homes for everyone. Iqaluit expanded rapidly when Nunavut became an official Canadian territory in 1999. Canada's largest territory is home to many Inuit communities. About 90% of the province's residents are indigenous. The government is a major employer in Iqaluit, alongside more traditional activities like fishing, hunting, and carving. Iqaluit's new status as a capital brought a surge of new public sector workers, along with accompanying rise in construction and government buildings and houses. Many residents have their housing subsidized either by their employer or by the government if they are low income, so prices are unlikely to come down. At the same time, Iqaluit, like its circumpolar neighbors, faces a housing crisis of a different sort. The houses are sinking into the warming earth. The only men's homeless shelter is perpetually overcrowded. Men share rooms with several bunk beds pressed close together. When I met him in late 2016, Charlie Papazzi had been living at the shelter for about 2 years. He had lost his last home when he was fired from his job, which had provided housing. He was fired, Papazzi said, because of a drinking problem. After that, he found himself on the icy streets of Iqaluit. Papazzi was trying to pull his life together. He was working at a construction company as a warehouse manager and still trying to get government-assisted housing. "I'm on the list," he said, but he had no idea when he might have his own home again. "I've been on the list going on 5 years now," he added, shaking his head. Housing in Iqaluit has been tough to find for years, and climate change is making everything more complicated, destabilizing the housing market across the Arctic. Housing, as you've probably seen, is extremely expensive out here. "People can barely afford a home," said Colleen Healy, the climate change program manager for the government of Nunavut. "It's even worse if your home has a half-life now, because the permafrost under your house is thawing. Temperatures in the Arctic continue to soar at double the rate for the rest of the world. At the same time, precipitation patterns are also changing all over the planet. In the Arctic, that means more erratic snowfall. These changes are affecting the very basis of the Arctic, the land. It's difficult to build new houses on thawing permafrost, and many existing houses have huge cracks in the foundation. It is also extremely expensive to ship materials in the Arctic, so the houses that are repaired and built must be planned very carefully. In my lifetime, it's a totally different Arctic," Healy said. "It's a totally different Nunavut." Permafrost is any stretch of ground, including soil and bedrock, that remains frozen for 2 years or more. The top layer, the active layer, freezes and thaws with the seasons, but the layer beneath stays at 0 degrees Celsius for multiple years. Or it's supposed to, anyway. As temperatures soar and snow blankets the earth in new weather patterns, even permafrost that's been around for thousands of years is beginning to give way. The landscape of the Arctic is changing more than it has since the end of the last ice age. "Permafrost reflects everything that's happening on top," explained Dmitry Streletsky, an assistant professor of geography at George Washington University. "Warmer temperatures will result in permafrost thaw." Permafrost thaw is not a new problem. Urban planners, architects, and builders have taken its volatility into account for decades in the Arctic. But climate change exacerbates existing permafrost issues, and it does so rapidly. The main problem has to do with soil moisture. When water freezes, it expands, so the ground rises. Conversely, when it thaws and the soil contracts, the ground sinks. Permafrost in many places across the Arctic is now locked in a pattern of thawing and refreezing each new season, where once it remained steady. The ground rises and sinks with each change in the weather. Across the Arctic, roads and buildings buckle along with the ground. Russia is home to some of the largest cities in the Arctic, which are undergoing profound changes because of permafrost thaw. In the coal mining town of Vorkuta, about 40% of buildings have become deformed from the changes in the ground. In Norilsk, the largest city built on permafrost, about 60% of buildings have been damaged by permafrost thaw, and 10% of the houses in the city have been abandoned. Most of the changes happen gradually, but they can render buildings dangerous once they begin. A few years ago in Norilsk, a cement slab broke a doctor's legs when a building shifted and crumbled. Other circumpolar regions face infrastructure challenges from the warming earth. In Greenland, wildfires have swept over previously icy tundra, coming dangerously close to towns and research stations. In some places here, finding and storing water can be a problem. Water kept in tanks must be thawed to use, and the heated tanks then heat the permafrost. In Alaska, many towns are running out of places to bury their dead. Erstwhile cemeteries have become marshy swamps, and some towns are running out of solid ground entirely. Nutak recently received federal funding to begin relocating the entire town to safer ground. Other towns like Shemsmaref and Kivalina may also move in the next few years or risk disappearing entirely. But there are some relatively simple techniques that officials and urban planners in the Arctic can implement. Removing accumulated snow from the ground is one easy way to keep the permafrost intact. There's a reason snow is called a blanket. It actually insulates the earth, keeping it warmer than the outside air. When it's removed, the ground is exposed to cooler temperatures. In spring, when that snow begins to melt, preventing it from seeping into the ground is another important part of protecting permafrost. Water is warm, Strelitsky noted. It's not frozen, so it affects permafrost as well. Houses built directly on the ground can also thaw the soil with their escaped heat. So most homes in the Arctic are balanced on wooden or metal pilings driven deep into the permafrost. Other houses rest on screw jacks, adjustable bases that can be cranked up or down as the earth shifts. These stilts allow air to move over the ground, keeping it cool. Although pilings and screw jacks are now used extensively in the Arctic, the additional materials and efforts to dig into the permafrost makes construction costs even higher. The Arctic foundations are considerably more expensive in permafrost areas, said Strelitsky. For example, for large residential apartment buildings in Russia, the cost of the foundation can be as high as 30% of the structure. And since pilings and screw jacks both rest on permafrost, they're imperfect solutions. Thawing ground can disrupt even the best foundations. One hospital in Alaska went to extremes to make sure the ground would stay solid. The Yukon Kuskokwim Health Facility in Bethel refrigerates the ground with temperature-controlled probes installed in the ground. But this, Strelitsky said, is not really a sustainable solution for most Arctic infrastructure. It's expensive, and it likely wouldn't be worth it for most buildings and roads in the Arctic. Instead, a technology called thermosiphon is gaining in popularity. Thermosiphons are narrow tubes that passively pull heat from the ground and ventilate it up into the air, keeping the heat away from the permafrost. They are rather straightforward to install and relatively inexpensive compared with the alternatives. With every problem, first you have to know that there is a problem, as Strelitsky put it. In the case of permafrost thaw, the first step should be monitoring the ground temperature. This, Strelitsky pointed out, is much cheaper than losing an entire building. Yet many Arctic cities have not yet implemented monitoring, which could lead to expensive, long-term problems. Once the damage becomes visible, it's often too late. In Nunavut, there are more than 100 boreholes that have been measured ground temperatures since 2000. In Iqaluit, Charlie Papazzi's hometown, officials are taking even bigger steps to monitor the ground from the air. We've been developing permafrost hazard maps for Nunavut, said Colleen Healy. The government of Nunavut is working with the Canadian Space Agency to detect changes and shifts in the ground via satellites. We can actually see movement within 3 millimeters, Healy said. Once these changes are corroborated by on-the-ground researchers, they develop maps to help planners decide where to build next and which houses to monitor for potential problems. If homes need to be retrofitted, either the government or the homeowner pays for the work, depending on who owns it. It's pretty much impossible to get insurance or sell a house once permafrost damage starts to show. Holding up a map of Iqaluit, Healy said, "The blue areas are the most ice-rich. Those are the highest-risk areas. When those big chunks of ice thaw, you can get buildings tilting and changing." Then she pointed to a strip of brown, bedrock. "That's the solid rock. That's not moving anywhere." With her index finger, Healy circled a spot on the map. The city was actually planning on making this whole blue zone the new development areas, she said. The idea was to build houses and government buildings there. And when we did this map, they were like, "Okay, let's not do that. Let's develop over here on that brown area." Building only on bedrock can create disjointed, sprawling cities. And in larger cities, it may introduce transportation problems. But it's one reliable way to know the ground isn't going to give way under your feet. "Iqaluit's growing," Healy said. "How can I make sure that the Iqaluit of 40, 50, 100 years from now is better?" This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in CityLab.com, part of the Atlantic Monthly Group. We'll read a couple of the business columns this week. The first, economy, the best jobs market in years. Unemployment in the U.S. right now is about as low as it gets, said Mark Whitehouse in Bloomberg.com. Propelled by a record 92 consecutive months of job growth, the U.S. unemployment rate sank to 3.8% in May, its lowest level since April 2000. The last time the rate was lower was in 1969. Sectors across the economy contributed to the 223,000 added jobs last month, from manufacturing to healthcare to retail. The unemployment rate for college graduates fell to just 2% and to only 3.9% for those with high school diploma. Joblessness among African Americans tumbled from 6.6% to a record low 5.9%. And for the first time ever, the number of job openings now exceeds the number of unemployed Americans. The only question from this month's report is whether there are enough synonyms for good, said Neil Irwin in NYTimes.com. Even persistently lackluster wage growth may finally be rebounding. Average earnings are up 2.7% year over year, slightly faster than inflation. Clearly, the economy is in a sweet spot. President Trump's tax reform and deregulation agenda appears to be working, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Employers are adding jobs and raising wages, and that's encouraging workers who are often on the edges of the economy to come off the sidelines. Notably, the number of people who have been jobless for 27 weeks or more has fallen by 476,000 over the past year. We just hope that a trade war doesn't blow this impressive progress. It's natural for President Trump to want to claim responsibility for the roaring economy, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. When the economy does well, presidents of both parties routinely brag about the results. But the true impact of his tax cuts, regulation rollbacks, and tariffs won't be clear for years. What's really powering the economy is the economy. Its forward march is less the product of any partisan policy than it is the steady growth of purchasing power and the restoration of consumer confidence. Before you get too excited, some perspective, said Paul Davidson in USA Today. The labor force participation rate, the percentage of Americans working or who have actively looked for work in the past month, is 62.7%. In 2000, the last time unemployment was this low, the participation rate was 67%. Our next challenge, then, is to reintegrate the many Americans ages 25 to 54 who remain outside the workforce, particularly because of the opioid crisis. The economy of 2000 was also completely different. Back then, GDP grew at a robust 4.1%, and the federal budget was in surplus. In comparison, the U.S. economy grew 2.3% in 2017, and our budget deficit is likely to hit $1 trillion next year. That's why if you suggested to most Americans that the economy is as healthy as it was back in 2000, they'd probably laugh in your face, said Jeff Spross in TheWeek.com. Inequality is worse, wage growth is slower, and more people are working as independent contractors, giving employers more leverage to drive down pay and cut benefits. The headline numbers look great right now, but compared with 18 years ago, 3.8% unemployment just ain't what it used to be. Walmart schools its workers. Walmart is trying to change the narrative about how it treats its employees, said Adam Harris. The retail behemoth announced last week that it will pick up the tab for its 1.4 million employees to earn either associate's or bachelor's degrees in business or supply chain management at three selected universities. Workers will have to pay the equivalent of $1 per day as sort of a copay, but they won't be required to stay with the company once they graduate. Subsidizing employee education isn't groundbreaking. Starbucks, JetBlue, UPS, and Cigna all have programs, but it is good PR, especially since Walmart has long been criticized for its low wages, lack of room for career growth, and stingy benefits. It also signals just how desperate Walmart is to keep its staff. The retailer has for years suffered from an abysmal retention rate, and with the economy improving, it's becoming harder to attract and keep employees. The retailer has already this year boosted base pay to $11 per hour and expanded paid maternity leave from 6 to 10 weeks. It also knows that helping employees go to college pays off. Cigna's program, which helped 2,200 workers from 2012 to 2014, lowered turnover by 8% and provided a 129% return on investment. And beyond the boost to Walmart, a lot of employees stand to benefit. We're on the health and science page now. The lead article is titled, Fewer Americans Dying of Cancer. Thanks to healthier habits and advances in treatments and detection, fewer men, women, and children in the U.S. are dying from cancer each year. A new government progress report on the war against the disease found that between 1999 and 2015, overall cancer death rates fell by 1.8% annually among men and by 1.4% each year among women, the Los Angeles Times reports. Fewer Americans died from many common forms of the disease, including lung, breast, prostate, and colon cancers. Overall, the number of new cancer cases dropped 1% per year between 2008 and 2014. Scientists attribute these positive trends to earlier diagnoses, new and improved treatment options, smoking cessation, and healthier lifestyle habits. This year's report is an encouraging indicator of progress we're making in cancer research, says National Cancer Institute Director Dr. Ned Sharpless. But despite overall declines in cancer deaths, mortality rates for certain forms of the disease, including cancers of the liver, pancreas, uterus, and brain, are actually on the rise for complex reasons, such as hepatitis C infections, which affect the liver, and obesity, which raises risk for various forms of cancer. Cancer remains the number two cause of death in the U.S. diagnosis by artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence can detect skin cancer more accurately than experienced dermatologists, new research shows. Scientists in the United States, Germany, and France taught a machine learning system known as Deep Learning Convolutional Neural Network, CNN, to identify skin cancer by showing it more than 100,000 images of malignant melanomas and harmless moles. When pitted against the skills and experience of 58 dermatologists from 17 different countries, the machine came out on top. The CNN correctly identified 95% of melanomas out of a total of 300 images. In a similar test, the doctors picked up 87% of the melanomas. The human's accuracy improved slightly once they were given additional photos and patient information, but even doctors with many years of experience were still bested by the CNN, which missed fewer melanomas and misdiagnosed fewer benign moles, reports ScienceDaily.com. It's still too early to use AI in standard clinical practice, doctors who reviewed the study said, but sooner rather than later, machines will be making diagnoses. Leg movement key for brain health. Using your legs in weight-bearing exercise is critical for brain health, new research shows. Researchers found that moving the large muscles of the legs through activities such as walking, climbing stairs, and running triggers the production of stem cells in the brain, helping that critical organ to renew itself. We are meant to be active, to walk, run, crouch to sit, and use our leg muscles to lift things, study author Rafaela Adami tells MedicalNewsToday.com. For the study, researchers immobilized the hind legs of a group of mice for 28 days, then examined a specific area of their brains known as the subventricular zone. They found the neural stem cell activity of the mice had plummeted by 70%. Declines in oxygen levels associated with reduced physical activity also altered the rodent's metabolism. These findings may explain why the health of people who are bedridden often deteriorates rapidly. And we'll finish out on the Talking Points page, as we often do. We have an article here titled, Puerto Rico, the Real Death Toll. We now know that Hurricane Maria's assault on Puerto Rico was one of the most destructive natural disasters in recent American history, said Van Newkirk II in TheAtlantic.com. Virtually everyone knew that the official tally of 64 dead in the U.S. territory was a massive undercount. But a recently published study by public health researchers at Harvard University put the death toll of last year's hurricane at more than 70 times that figure. Researchers estimate that roughly 4,600 people died as a result of the storm, one-third of them due to lack of medical services. By comparison, the official death toll for Hurricane Katrina in 2005 was just over 1,800 people. President Trump's profound failure of leadership and management contributed to Puerto Rico's agony, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. The president could have rallied Americans behind the beleaguered island. Instead, Trump sent every signal that he simply didn't care. When it became clear that the government's belated relief efforts were falling short, Trump responded by blaming the Puerto Ricans for not doing enough to help themselves and picking a Twitter fight with the mayor of San Juan. Look at how differently Trump responded to Puerto Rico and Houston after Hurricane Harvey, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger in an editorial. The government sent 73 helicopters to Houston within 6 days, whereas it took more than 3 weeks to send 70 to Puerto Rico. By then, many people had already died for lack of water, food, and medical care. FEMA quickly approved $142 million in assistance for Harvey's victims, compared with $6.2 million for Maria victims. 9 days after Harvey, the feds had 30,000 personnel in Houston, while in the same time period, only 10,000 were sent to Puerto Rico. FEMA waited 5 days to send a hospital ship to San Juan. Why did the Trump administration treat Puerto Ricans like second-class citizens? Clearly, we need a congressional investigation into this debacle, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. When four Americans were killed at a diplomatic post in Benghazi, Libya, Congress spent years trying to figure out why. Even if the Harvard study's estimates are too high, it's clear that hundreds, and more likely thousands, died, some of them needlessly. We need to know what the government could have done differently. The people of Puerto Rico deserve at least that. Trump's pardons, setting a new standard. President Trump is on a pardoning spree, said Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. Last week, Trump pardoned Dinesh D'Souza, a right-wing provocateur who pleaded guilty to felony campaign finance violations in 2014 and suggested there's more to come. Martha Stewart, who was convicted of lying to federal investigators, could be next. Trump may also commute former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich's prison sentence for trying to sell Barack Obama's open U.S. Senate seat. Trump's motivations are obvious. Pardoning D'Souza, whose long history of racist trolling includes calling Obama boy and mocking Rosa Parks, is another reminder to hate mongers that they will always have a champion in the White House. The same was true of his pardon of the anti-immigrant, openly racist Sheriff Joe Arpaio. And by doling out pardons for lying, obstruction of justice, and outright corruption, Trump is also sending a message to the likes of Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, and Michael Cohen. Everyone in America who helps Donald Trump will eventually get a pardon. President Trump's pardon of Dinesh D'Souza is just, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. There's no question D'Souza broke the law. He funneled illegal donations to a Republican Senate candidate through straw donors. But such crimes are usually punished with a fine. Partisan prosecutors asked for a 7-year prison sentence, and D'Souza ultimately spent several months in a halfway house. The president's pardon powers are meant to serve as a bulwark against this kind of injustice. Sorry, but Trump's not interested in justice, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg.com. Previous presidents went through a rigorous Justice Department process of evaluating pardon requests. But Trump has substituted personal and arbitrary standards, bypassing the pardon application process altogether. He's granting clemency to people who haven't even asked for it. This looks a lot like autocratic rule. Trump's shameless abuse of the pardon power may be one of his most damaging legacies, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. Under Trump, the pardon has been transformed from a rare instrument of mercy into an everyday tool of culture war, used to reward the administration's friends and troll its enemies. Future presidents will naturally be tempted to follow suit. New executive powers, once unsheathed, are seldom and only slowly reversed. And we'll read some of the shorter notes. Now, let's see. Half of the world's population, about 3.6 billion people, now use the Internet, according to the annual Internet Trends Report. President Trump has spent more of the taxpayers' money, at least $17 million, for his weekend trips to Mar-a-Lago than the $16.7 million the Mueller investigation has cost thus far. Starting in 2019, Vermont will begin offering $10,000 grants to workers who want to move to the state while working remotely for companies based elsewhere. China is on track to surpass the U.S. in spending on scientific research by the end of this year. The U.S. spends $500 billion annually on research, but China has been increasing its spending by an average of 18% a year and is now luring foreign scientists and retaining Chinese who used to immigrate to the U.S. Republicans have aired more than 14,000 campaign ads that include Trump-style immigration messaging about the wall and sanctuary cities. Democrats have run more than 26,000 ads promising a better health care system. On the poll watch, 47% of adult men surveyed on the Me Too movement say they have not discussed the movement with anyone ever. But 35% say they have changed their dating habits in response. I couldn't choose among the quotes this week, so I'm going to read three of them to you. The first is from Albert Einstein, who says, "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking that we used when we created them." This one comes from Thomas Jefferson, quoted in the Maryville Daily Forum. "Our liberties depend on the freedom of the press, and that cannot be limited without being lost." And finally, singer Tony Bennett, quoted in The Guardian, says, "Life teaches you how to live it, if you live long enough." And on that note, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.